How can a microchip manufacturer keep track of 250 million control points at once?
How can technology behind animated movies help enterprises reimagine their future?
Built for Change listeners know those answers and more. I'm Elise Hu.
And I'm Josh Klein. We're the hosts of Built for Change, a podcast from Accenture.
We talk to leaders of the world's biggest companies to hear how they've reinvented their business to create industry-shifting impact.
And how you can, too.
New episodes are coming soon, so check out Built for Change wherever you get your podcasts.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, the White House adds two more countries to its travel ban. North Korea is one of them. Why is the other one Chad? And the day after the ban is updated, the Supreme Court cancels arguments on the case. Does that mean the new ban is legally sound? It's Tuesday, September 26th.
The new presidential order to take effect on October 18th adds new restrictions on travelers and immigrants from North Korea, Chad, and Venezuela.
The list is Chad, Iran, Libya, North Korea, Somalia.
The new ban removes Sudan from that list, but adds restrictions on immigrants and visitors from North Korea, Venezuela, and Chad.
Eric Schmidt, why Chad? Why is it on the list now?
Well, I was baffled. Chad is a large, landlocked country in the middle of northern Africa. It's about twice the size of Texas, mostly desert, one of the poorest countries in the world. And it's in one of a belt of Muslim-majority nations across this part of western Africa, along with Sudan and Niger, Mali. But you don't have a lot of people coming from Chad to the United States. It has not been known as a major exporter of Islamic terrorism is some other countries, Pakistan or Syria, things like that. This is the first time I've heard anybody talk about a potential threat coming out of Chad toward the United States.
What about the people of Chad? How much of a surprise was this for them to suddenly show up on a list where you are banned from traveling to the United States?
Well, they were flabbergasted. I mean, Chad has actually been a very important partner for the United States in the fight against terrorism.
These are, we are told, over 100 girls who were abducted by Boko Haram, seen here wearing the full-length hijab.
Chad is in a very rough neighborhood. It has extremists from Boko Haram coming from one direction. It has ISIS fighters filtering down from Libya from another direction.
13 soldiers from Chad have died while fighting the Islamist rebels.
It has refugees from the Darfur crisis coming from Sudan.
War in South Sudan has created more refugees than Syria or Iraq has in a year.
And so this is a country with limited resources is trying to do a lot to stave off these problems. And the United States has the military and its special operations forces have developed a pretty good relationship with Chad over the years as the threat from Boko Haram in northeast Nigeria has grown even more worrisome to all these countries in the region.
Preparing for exfil.
So what the U.S. has done in the last several years is send Green Beret trainers into Chad and to work with them. And sometimes it's just basic things like marksmanship, but it's also getting into more complicated tactics, such as how you combat an ambush, or how you conduct a riverine option, special operations raids from the rivers onto a suspected terrorist cell or a terrorist hideout. So I've actually been with the U.S. military and its special forces when they're on the ground in Chad. Just in March, for instance, I watched a particular operation where the Chadians, these American-trained counterterrorism forces, were in these flat-bottom boats that were roaring down a river right outside the capital in Chad. And with them were American military trainers. And these boats roared up to the beach, and these commandos, carrying their rifles, stormed the beach and quickly dispersed onto the shore, and they targeted a mock terrorist hideout. And they burst into the doors, and you could hear the shooting. This is all, you know, blanks and all, but it's quite the scene. And with great speed, they grab whoever they were targeting inside, and they grab various terrorist paraphernalia, whatever computer stuff or cell phones they might have carried. And just as quickly, they rush back to the shores, and the boats are still revving their engines there. They all pile back into these boats, and upriver they go, roaring away.
So this is a simulation of an attack that the Chadian military would wage on, whether it's Boko Haram or Al-Qaeda or ISIS, someone that the United States saw as an enemy terrorist group.
That's right. But rather than the U.S. doing it with their own special forces, they're trying to train various militaries in this region to do it for themselves. That's one of the big carryovers, of course. The Trump administration is embraced from the Obama administration, not pouring a lot of additional special forces in places, but trying to build up the capabilities so these police and militaries can do it on their own with some U.S. help.
So just to be clear, Chad is a more or less formal military partner to the United States.
Yes, in terms of the fight in Africa, very much so. They're seen as a very important partner in going after many of these different terrorist groups there.
America and our partners are committed to stripping terrorists of their territory, cutting off their funding, and exposing the false allure of their evil ideology.
You said, Eric, that this military relationship between the United States and Chad has carried over from the Obama administration to the Trump administration. Has that relationship become even stronger? Or what exactly has happened under President Trump?
Well, in fact, when I was on the ground in March, the Chadians were saying that they welcomed Trump. They thought that he might even be better than Obama because he was such a tough talker on terrorism.
Terrorists who slaughter innocent people will find no glory in this life or the next. They are nothing but thugs and criminals and predators and, that's right, losers.
And they thought that the U.S. might actually send even more equipment, do even more training to help them combat the threats that they faced on the ground every day there. And I think they were anticipating, the Chadians were, that their relationship would become even closer under this administration.
Working alongside our allies, we will break their will, dry up their recruitment, keep them from crossing our borders. And yes, we will defeat them, and we will defeat them handily.
So, given everything that you've just told me, the amount of work that the Chad government and military are doing on behalf of the United States, the investment that the United States has placed in Chad and in its deft-sounding military, why is Chad now showing up on this travel ban list? It doesn't quite compute.
So the United States went to dozens of countries, including Chad, and asked them for some basic information, including the histories of potential criminals or terrorists who could come to the United States, their ability to share information not only with the U.S., but with international law enforcement agencies, and also just a general state of whether they're terrorists, in their country or not. And for whatever reason, the Chadians have not been able to provide that level of detail, that kind of information. It's hard to tell whether that's willful or, which may be more likely, they just don't have the technology to produce the names of people that they might suspect.
And when you say this might be a technical issue, what do you mean by that?
The country is so poor. I'm just not sure in its data banks what it has in terms of its citizenry, how extensive a file and how much kind of assurances that can actually give Washington that the people applying for visas, for instance, to come visit the United States don't have some connection, familial or otherwise, to some groups that might be dangerous. They may just not have that ability to screen people like that.
And if it might be willful, as you say, or it might be political, the motivation for withholding this information to the United States, why might the Chadian government not want to give the U.S. this info?
Well, that's the big question right now, Michael. What would be the hesitation on their part? It may just be they don't feel that they should have to prove themselves one more time to the United States government after all they've done in helping the U.S. on the ground and arguably very dangerous missions in this territory against a range of threats.
–
So the U.S. is still asking Chad to fight it, some of these kind of proxy battles against terrorist groups in Africa while banning its residents from traveling to the United States.
Absolutely. Chad is a key player in this fight, and it will want to continue, and the military will want to continue supporting that. The American military officials who work day in, day out with the Chadians are very frustrated because they feel they've been trying to build elements of trust over the years with the Chadian military. And then here comes the Trump administration with basically a gut punch to the Chadian government. And it's kind of hard for these American Special Forces guys to face their Chadian colleagues after something like that.
Given that Chad is helping the U.S. try to stabilize a part of the world that is pretty rampant with terrorist cells and terrorist sympathizers, where does this leave the larger project of trying to eliminate terrorism in the region of Africa we're talking about?
Well, I think it actually could undercut it. I mean, if its neighbors are looking around and saying that Chad, which has been a linchpin in the counterterrorism fight for the last several years, is being treated like this by the United States, I think other countries may pause before they're all in, particularly if this country feels that its sacrifices, what it's done in this kind of fight, are no longer not appreciated, but are being used against them. When I was talking to American generals today, that they feel this may be so demoralizing, just may be so angry, they may just stop cooperating and reduce their cooperation. And then you've actually created a bigger problem for yourself by putting them on this list.
We'll be right back.
I'm Shane Goldmacher. I'm a national political correspondent for the New York Times covering the 2024 election. I have off and on for years covered the role of money in politics, and that means sifting through tens of thousands of line items in campaign reports, looking at who's getting paid, how much they're getting paid, who's donating to these campaigns, who's reserved the most ads on Google, who's this billionaire changing the shape of the race with a single check. Look, the campaign spin, the strategists tell you one thing, the numbers don't really lie, and those numbers help us ask the right questions. That's what's so special about the New York Times. We get to tap the collective knowledge and wisdom of my colleagues who have expertise in every nook and cranny of this country and this campaign trail to tell you the full story of what's happening in these critical moments in the last few weeks of the election. If this kind of coverage is important to you, you can support it by subscribing to the New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Adam Liptak, we've been talking about one of the two countries that was just added to the president's travel ban, which is Chad. I want to ask you about the other country, North Korea. What's notable about that one that's different from the other six nations on the list?
Well, the obvious thing is that there aren't a lot of Muslims in North Korea.
Right.
You know, North Korea is easy. It's a gimme. And it is, with each passing day, a sworn enemy of the United States. So it's easy to put it into the mix. So I don't think adding North Korea to a list of predominantly Muslim countries inoculates you from the charge that you are executing what you promised to do in your presidential campaign, which is institute a Muslim ban.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
And Adam, that goes back to a very particular rally that the president held where he delivered this now famous pledge. So what's the explanation for why the president would add a non-Muslim majority country to the travel ban?
Well, the cynic would say it's to disguise the fact that he continues to want to implement what is in effect a Muslim ban. I guess I would say that there probably needs to come a time when whatever he said in the campaign and whatever he said in a series of ill-considered tweets, you do have to ask the question, is he permanently disabled from ever controlling immigration as presidents are authorized to do, or do we tag him with those statements from the campaign forever?
And what's the answer?
It would be easier to give him credit if it wasn't, you know, basically the same nations, plus Chad, plus North Korea, plus a few people from Venezuela. this latest version of the travel ban was the product of an intense deliberation by the Department of Homeland Security and other agencies. I don't want to second guess them when they say they use neutral criteria to come up with this list of nations, but it's a little bit surprising how closely the latest travel ban 3.0 maps on to the earlier ones.
Remind us what was so legally problematic about the travel ban in the first place, given what the president had said.
The courts had two kinds of problems with the initial travel bans. One is they said it violated the Constitution's protections against religious discrimination by singling out Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
The second was that although the president has vast statutory authority over immigration, particularly for reasons of national security, he has to give some kind of reasonable explanations for his decisions. And the court said, or one court said in particular, he hasn't come up with the beginnings of a reasonable explanation.
For why he needed to do it and do it as drastically as he did.
That's right. Why he chose these nations.
The judges cited Trump's own tweets to back up their ruling, including one missive in which Trump tweeted, "That's right, we need a travel ban for certain dangerous countries, not some politically correct term that won't help us protect our people."
So, Adam, was adding North Korea and a small part of Venezuela, as you said, was that effective in changing the religious discriminatory objections to the original travel ban? Because on Monday, the very next day after the new travel ban was announced, we saw that the Supreme Court said it was going to cancel oral arguments in a case about the original ban, which was scheduled for October. That seems effective.
Right. Well, it's effective in a narrow sense. Anytime a new executive order replaces an earlier one, the court's going to say, wait a second, that requires a fresh challenge in the lower courts. We'll look at that when it comes back to us. And that's likely what happened. But that doesn't tell us really anything about whether Travel Ban 3.0 is any good. And it depends a little bit on what you're asking about, Michael, which is, do the new nations map onto the old nations too closely?
Mm-hmm.
And is North Korea kind of a shell game, a gimme? But I think the courts will also look at the separate question of, were these nations arrived at through a measured, deliberate, thorough process to single out those places that we need to be afraid of for terrorist attacks? The government did a much more careful job this time than the earlier times. Is it good enough? Time will tell.
It doesn't really seem like anyone is trying to travel to the U.S. from North Korea because of the enormous restrictions and the repressive nature of that regime. So is that the kind of detail and reality that the courts will be looking at as they try to assess whether this is a legitimate new travel ban or essentially a kind of a flimsy revision of the original one?
On that point, you're absolutely right. I mean, North Korea can't be the answer to sanitizing the Muslim ban.
So is there anything else that's different about this version of the travel ban that seems designed to protect it legally?
Well, I don't know which way this cuts, but this one is indefinite. The earlier ones were meant to be a pause while the administration did the work it felt it needed to do.
Right, for 90 days, right.
You're right, to impose the kind of vetting it needed to do. This one is that. This one is, we've now figured it out, and we will, from now going forward until something changes, use this set of countries and use these restrictions and these vetting procedures. So in a way, this is the better one to really assess and challenge, because this is the one that's the product of the administration's considered deliberations.
You said you don't know which way it cuts, as in it's unclear whether being more permanent makes it more legally sound or less legally sound. Is that what you mean?
That's right. No, I would think that the courts give a little bit of credit to somebody trying to do work on the fly versus somebody who says, we've put our shoulders to this and we've come up with this plan after close scrutiny, and here's what we think really works.
So I want to ask about intent in all of this, because the Trump administration had already revised the original ban back in March to address the legal challenges that we're talking about, saying, you know, this really wasn't religious discrimination. And it seemed the reason it went up to the Supreme Court was that the courts were saying, it doesn't matter what the plan says now, your original intentions were discriminatory. So can a new order change original intentions? I realize this is starting to sound a little theoretical.
No, but it's a really excellent question. And what the ACLU says when it looks at this latest version of the travel ban is essentially, listen, if this happened on day one, if Jeb Bush or Mitt Romney had come into office and after due deliberation set up this set of nations, we might not think it's good policy, but it might be lawful. The problem is that it comes from a president who in his campaign statements and in his tweets and in his public statements after being president has insisted that he wants to have something that's not politically correct, that he, as he said in the campaign, wants a Muslim ban. And those statements may taint everything he does in this area. It may be he can never cure himself, no matter how many iterations he goes through, of that original sin.
We have entire regions of the world destabilized by terrorism and ISIS. For this reason, I issued an executive order to temporarily suspend immigration from places where it cannot safely occur.
Here's what else you need to know today. Senate Republicans say their last-ditch plan to repeal the Affordable Care Act is dead. On Monday afternoon, senators held the first and only congressional hearing on the legislation, where Democratic senators like Ron Wyden assailed the bill.
Colleagues, nobody has got to buy a lemon just because it's the last car on the lot. This Trump care bill is a health care lemon. A disaster in the making. The fact that it's the last Republican repeal bill standing doesn't make it okay.
Protesters interrupted the hearing, and the Congressional Budget Office issued a report saying the bill would force millions of Americans to lose their health insurance.
I just got the report, the Congressional Budget Office report. It says what millions of Americans will likely lose their health insurance if this legislation were enacted.
Minutes after the report was released, Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine said she would oppose the legislation, joining Rand Paul of Kentucky and John McCain of Arizona, and leaving Republicans without enough votes to pass the bill by a September 30th deadline. And
since the United States declared war on our country, we will have every right to make countermeasures.
North Korea is threatening to shoot down U.S. warplanes, even if they are not in the country's airspace, as tensions between the two countries continue to escalate. During a news conference outside of the United Nations on Monday, North Korea's foreign minister, Ri Yong-ho, called such an attack a justifiable response to President Trump's threat last week to totally destroy the North, which it considers a declaration of war.
Does the White House view President Trump's comments at the UN as a declaration of war?
White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders disputed that.
Not at all. We've not declared war on North Korea, and frankly, the suggestion of that is absurd.
Finally, former Congressman Anthony Weiner has been sentenced to 21 months in prison for sending lewd images to a minor in a case that changed the course of last year's presidential campaign. As police investigated Weiner, they discovered emails belonging to his wife, Huma Abedin, a senior aide to Hillary Clinton. That led to an announcement days before the election that the FBI had opened a new inquiry into Clinton's use of email, a decision Clinton says contributed to her defeat. At his sentencing in Manhattan, Weiner said, quote, "I acted not only unlawfully, but immorally. And if I had done the right thing, I would not be standing before you today." That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.